If you remembered in the book of Esther, Haman had a plan to eliminate all the Jews just because he resented one of them. His name was Mordecai. That was in chapter 3. He presented his plan to the king, and the plan was approved. He was excited to get rid of all the Jews, especially that man Mordecai. Mordecai did not just sit there and wait to be killed. He came up with a plan of his own to defend himself and defend all the Jews against that man, Haman, in chapter 4. He convinced his cousin, Esther, the queen, to go in and talk to the king. Reluctantly, she agreed to do it. She knew that it was risky. She could be killed if her husband was not happy to see her. And women today think that their husbands are bad. Tonight, we continue the story, and we will see the plan of Esther. Everybody had a plan. She needed to be wise, or she could lose her life. So tonight, we get to the heart of the story. It is filled with action and suspense, something that Raymond likes. So. All right, chapter 5 deals with Esther's courage in proceeding to obtain favor. There's two parts to chapter 5. First, we see the invitation, verses 1 to 8. And then we will see the suggestion in verses 9 to 14. So let's start with the invitation of Esther. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half my kingdom." So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." So starting here, we see that the reversal of the extermination of the Jews was quite a job, was not an easy thing to reverse. It starts here in chapter 5, and it goes all the way to chapter 9. So after her 3 days of fasting, in chapter 4, verse 16, she was ready to go to the king with her request. So even though she had not been with the king for over a month, we were told in chapter 4, verse 11, he was pleased to see her when she came, and he held out the scepter towards her in verse 2. He even offered to give her whatever she wanted, up to half of the kingdom, in verse 3. This is just an expression. He did not mean it. This is just to express that Esther could request whatever she would desire and it would be fulfilled. Esther's request was very simple. She did not want anything near half of his kingdom. She asked that the king and Haman, his right-hand man, come to the banquet that she had prepared. That's in verse 4. In verses 5 to 8, the king and Haman went to the banquet of Esther, verse 5. During the meal, the king again tried to find out what the queen wanted. in verse 6. So Esther simply asked for the king and Haman to return the following day for yet another banquet. Then she would make her request known to him. In verse 8. Now there are many opinions out there as to why Esther did not reveal Haman's plot at the first banquet. Some people said, oh, because she was afraid. Others said, oh, she had second thought. Or some say she sensed that the king was not in the right frame of mind that day. They can come up with whatever they want. It does not say. But we know that Esther had a lot of wisdom. She did not rush to plead for her people. She requested a second banquet to secure the success of her mission. Some people think that she had cold feet and could not ask. It was not procrastination. What she did was very wise, and it was of the Lord. As we continue the story, we will see that as she asked the request, there's a lot of stuff that could not have been done, like the gallows being prepared for Haman to be hung. So the Lord was in it, and she was obedient to the Lord. She was not procrastinating. So that's the first part. That's the invitation. At verse 9, we have the second part, and that is the suggestion. They will make a suggestion for Haman. So, filled with pride, Haman left the first banquet in good spirit. When he met Mordecai on the way out of the palace, he was filled with indignation in verse 9. But he restrained himself from violence. Calling his friends and his wife Zeresh together in verse 10, he told them about all the favorable things that had happened to him that day. It had been a great day for him. He had a promotion in verse 11, he says. Then he got an invitation to a banquet with the queen and the king in verse 12. So the only cloud on his horizon was that stubborn Jew in verse 13. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. That was the only thing bothering him. So his wife and his friends made a suggestion to him. They suggested for him to make a gallows 75 feet high. Then go get permission from the king to hang Mordecai on it. Verse 14. Your problem would be over. And this pleased Haman. He liked the suggestion. And he did have the gallows made 75 feet high. It is sad when people allow someone or something to get under their skin, and because of it, they cannot enjoy anything else. The Lord is good to them, has given them a lot of good stuff, but there's one little thing, a person or a thing that get under their skin, and like this Haman, his life could not be any better. And one man bugged him. So Haman was joyful and excited to be invited by the king and the queen again. Quite an honor. But the moment he saw Mordecai, all his joy was gone. So that is chapter 5, an invitation and a suggestion. The main lesson of chapter 5 is if we have spent time with God in prayer, we will find favor with men in time of need. God can turn the hearts of men any which way he pleases. So those who walk in sincerity with God may walk in security not fearing what men can do to them. Chapter 6 now deals with Haman being forced to exalt Mordecai, the man that he hates the most. There's two simple parts in chapter 6. First, the honor, verses 1 to 9, and then the humiliation in verses 10 to 14. So let's start with the honor for Mordecai. That night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So while Haman was sleeping, God kept the king awake to spoil the evil plan. So in trying to make the best of his insomnia, the king had the chronicles of his reign read to him. Now, you cannot use this scripture here to justify that the book of Chronicles is an excellent tool to put people to sleep. It was the chronicles of the event that had happened during his reign, not the book of Chronicles that we have. By divine fluke, the portion that was read, the king, that night, contained the account of the attempt on his life that had been foiled by Mordecai. Two of his servants planned to kill the king. Mordecai had heard it and told Esther, who told the king. So upon inquiry, he learned that nothing had ever been done to reward Mordecai for his faithful service. Now, commentator J.G. I mean, I always confuse the J and the G. Anyway, is J.G.? No, G.J. No, anyway. Mr. Bellet said, "There is plot upon plot, wheels within wheels, circumstances hanging upon circumstances, all twisted together to work out the wonderful plans of God." When you look back at what God has done, you can see all the connections that were made and all the circumstances, and it's a beautiful, wonderful plan of God. The Lord is in perfect control. In verses 4 to 9, Haman came in to suggest that the king hang Mordecai in verse 5. Strangely enough, it was at the very same time that the king had an impulse to reward the man who had saved him from the assassin. When Haman entered, the king asked him a question in verse 6. "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now, thinking that who in the world would the king want to honor but me? Thinking that his own great moment had come, Haman suggested the most elaborate parade, wearing a royal robe and bestowing all kinds of honors, being second only to those of the king himself. Verses 7 and 8, he's got there, "Let a royal robe be brought in," and he's got a beautiful plan. Haman further suggested that even a public announcement be made as the parade went through the city. "Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Verse 9. He had a beautiful plan. It looked good. He was excited. For one moment, he did not think about Mordecai. He was so excited. It was a great day. Verse 10, now we have the second part. The honor is over. Now the humiliation. Then the king said to Haman, hasten, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe, walked really slowly, and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh, they said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuch came at the door and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So the king ordered Haman to hurry and bestow all these honors not on him, but on Mordecai the Jew. In verse 10, Haman had to go out, and he proclaimed his worst enemy as the man whom the king delighted to honor. Pride goes before the fall, and a haughty spirit before a fall. That's in Proverbs 16:18. Someone said, the proud has a mirror in which he sees himself. The humble has a window through which he sees others. That's the difference between the proud and the humble. In our day, there is a man, capital M, whom the king, capital K, delights to honor. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. God has decreed that every knee shall bow to him and every tongue confess to him, Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That's in Philippians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. So totally deflated, totally disappointed, Haman retreated to his house, verse 12, and reported these strange developments. His wife and his wise friends, they don't say he had a wise wife, but he had wise friends, they saw in these events an omen of victory for the Jew and defeat for Haman in verse 13. And by then it was time for Haman to hurry up and go to Esther's second banquet, verse 14. So the main lesson of this chapter 6, enemies should not expect to triumph over those who are in close fellowship with God. Chapter 7 now deals with Esther's accusation and Haman's execution. There's three short parts in this short chapter 7. First, there's the request, verses 1 to 4. Then there's the rage, verses 5 to 8. And then there is the reward in verses 9 and 10. So let's start with the request of Esther. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again asked to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half my kingdom. It shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So Esther's second banquet turned out to have implication that would shake the entire kingdom, starting with Haman's house. Things are going to change now. At the king's request in verse 2, she finally made her appeal. She asked for her own life and the lives of her people who had been sentenced to death. Verse 3. And she added in verse 4, had they been sold as slaves, she would have held her peace, even though the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So that's the first part, the request. She had a request. She wanted her life. Verse 5, we have the second part, the rage of the king. Then King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. I wish we could see his pants. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the palace of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So the king resentfully asked, who in the world had initiated such a terrible plot against Esther, his wife, and her people? In verse 5, the queen had wisely invited Haman for just this moment. To his face, she charged him, this wicked Haman, verse 6, he's the one. So Haman's true character was not fully revealed. Ahasuerus stepped out of the palace. He went to the garden like a raging panther. He could not believe. In verse 7, his conscience might have been bothering him too, as he remembered his part approving this terrible plan. And it was hitting much closer to home than he ever anticipated. Oh yeah, go ahead, destroy those people. Not knowing one was in his house, one was his wife. So in mortal fear, Haman threw himself before Queen Esther, pleading for his life. The king came back into the room, saw the man on his wife, interpreted this as an attempt to assault his wife sexually in verse 8. Haman's fate was now sealed. The man is as good as dead. Without an express word from the king, he did not say a single word, and the servants came and covered his face. That is a prelude to execution. That's the first thing that they would do. They would just put that black hood on the head and you knew that's the last thing you saw, you would never see anything. It meant that the person did not deserve to see the light of day anymore. His life is over. So that is the second part, that is the rage. And then verse 9 and 10, these two, we have the third part, the reward of Haman. So one of the eunuch named Harbona told the king about the gallows that Haman had built in verse 9. So the word got into the palace that Haman had been arrested. He's going to be put to death. And wanted to say, by the way, Haman, the guy you just arrested, he built a gallows 75 feet high. So the king ordered the scoundrel to be hanged on it. So Haman took Mordecai's place on the gallows in verse 10. He reaped what he had sown. Then the king's wrath ended. But how will the Jews escape the decree that cannot be changed? The main lesson of chapter 10 is mischief is sure to return upon the person who planned it. Psalm 7:16 says, "Trouble shall return upon the head of the wicked, and his violent dealing shall come down on his own crown." So that's a sure thing. Chapter 8 deals with the counter order of King Ahasuerus for the defense of the Jews. There are three parts to chapter 8. First, we see the petition, verses 1 to 6. Then there will be a proclamation, verses 7 to 14. And after that, the conversion, verses 15 to 17. So let's start with the petition of Queen Esther. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman, the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Amedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So Haman's house was given to Esther, verse 1, and his position was given to Mordecai, verse 2. Once again, Esther appeared before the king uninvited, careless of her own life, and tearfully she pleaded for her people. Again, the golden scepter was extended to her. That was the scepter of grace, verse 4. And Esther asked that the first decree be revoked. But according to the law of those people, no edict signed and sealed by a Persian king could be changed. It could not be altered. So we have the words of her plea in verses 5 and 6. She really was desperate with her petition. So that's the first part, the petition. Verses 7 to 14, we have the second part, and that is the proclamation of the king. We see in these verses the plan of King Ahasuerus, after reminding Esther of what he had already done on her behalf, in verse 7, giving her Haman's house and hanging him, the king permitted her and Mordecai to write another decree counteracting the first one in verse 8. The king's scribes then were called in verse 9, and Mordecai dictated an edict which gave the Jews the right to protect their own lives in verse 11. So God did not simply cancel the first decree like some Christian think that the Lord should have done. He could have done it, but he did not. They will have to do their part. They will have to fight and defend themselves. Earlier in the Old Testament, you remember God gave the children of Israel all the land that was before them, in front of them. Still, they had to fight for it before they were able to take possession of it. Christians today expect God to do everything for them. It won't happen. They are not willing to do any part. They just want to sit and pray. Wrong. We must do our part. We must do our best and then commit the rest to God. So here we have a decree. God could have simply have reversed this somehow. He did not let them fight for their freedom. Then with great speed, the new law was carried to the uttermost part of the kingdom on royal swift horses, we are told in verse 10. By courier on horseback riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. And a copy was sent to all 127 provinces, we are told in verse 13. And then at verse 15, we have the third part, the conversion. Now Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and a great crown of gold, and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews. They converted because fear of the Jews fell upon them. So having discarded his sackcloth, his garment of mourning, Mordecai left the palace in robe of splendor, verse 15. The Jews were filled with gladness when they heard of the sudden turn of event in verse 16. And the rest of the people, they were filled with fear, verse 17. And not wanting to be numbered among their enemies, many Gentiles were converted to the Jewish faith at that time. The main lesson of chapter 8 is let the odds be against God's people. All they have to do is include God in their plans, and he will open ways of deliverance for them for sure. Chapter 9 deals with a vengeance being executed, the Jews being victorious, and a feast being instituted. There's two parts in chapter 9. The first one is the victory of the Jews, verses 1 to 16, and then the holiday of the Jews, verses 17 to 32. So let's start with the victory of the Jews. Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, which would be our equivalent the month of March, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occur, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them, because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the princes, the governors, those doing the king's work, they helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. So when the fateful day finally arrived, the 13th day of the 12th month, the 13th of March, in verse 1, the Jews gathered together in their respective cities, verse 2, and they destroyed their enemies. Even the princes and their rulers, they helped the Jews, in verse 3, because they feared Mordecai, who was now the second most powerful man in the kingdom. Verse 4. In verses 6 to 16, we have the result. In the capital alone, 500 men were killed. Verse 6. Along with the 10 sons of Ammon. In verses 7 to 10. When it was reported to the king in verse 11, he realized that the slaughter in the rest of the land must be great as well. Verse 10. So Esther requested that an additional day be given the Jews in Shushan, that's the citadel, the bigger place of all, to wipe out any remaining pockets of anti-Semitism. In verse 13. And as a result, 300 more men were executed. In verse 15. And she also asked that the bodies of Ammon's 10 sons be publicly hanged, in verse 14. So in the king's provinces, the Jews killed 75,000 men, but had not taken any of their plunder, verse 16. And this would make it clear to everyone that they were interested only in protecting themselves, not in growing rich from those people. They did not touch any of their possession and their riches. And that's the first part, and that is the victory of the Jews. Now at verse 17, we have the second part, and that is the holiday of the Jews. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled themselves on the 13th day, as well as on the 14th day. And on the 15th day of the month, they rested and they made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and for sending presents to one another. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews in the provinces held a great feast on the 14th day of the month, while those at Shushan celebrated it on the 15th day. That's in verse 18. So Mordecai wrote those things and sent letters to all the Jews, in verse 20, that they should celebrate this holiday every year from now on, verses 21 and 22. In verses 23 to 28, the Jews accepted the custom, verse 23. And this was the beginning of the Feast of Purim, verse 26. The name Purim comes from Pur, which is lots, and that the lot that Aman had cast in chapter 3, verse 7. So later, Mordecai decreed that both the 14 and the 15 should be observed by all the Jewish people in verse 27. So like all the other feasts, it was to be celebrated annually as a reminder to succeeding generation of this marvelous deliverance. Verse 28. Down the road, people do not remember unless you make it a holiday. If we would not have certain holidays today, a lot of people would not even know that the United States were independent on the 4th of July. In verses 29 to 32, the end of this chapter 9, a second letter was written, this time by Queen Esther, and it went out to all the Jews, charging them to keep the Feast of Purim, verse 29. Mordecai also sent letters in verse 30. So two letters were sent to confirm the days of Purim, verse 31. And the book referred to in verse 32, so the decree of Esther confirmed this matter of Purim. It was written in the book. That book was probably the chronicles of that kingdom, not the books of the Bible. So the main lesson of this chapter 9, if we have received mercy, the only way to express our gratitude is to show mercy to others. Finally, the small one, chapter 10, the last one, deals with Mordecai being made prime minister. There's two short parts. First is the taxation, verse 1, and then the exaltation, verses 2 and 3. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute. Tribute is taxation on the land and on the island of the sea. So when it was calm again in the country, the king imposed a taxation everywhere. First, it was on the land. That is the 127 provinces that they had. And the second place, number two, is on the islands of the sea. That's not Hawaii, but the islands that they had conquered. It is believed that it was Mordecai who engineered this new system of taxation as a substitute for war and plunder for a source of kingdom wealth. A lot of kings got their wealth by attacking other countries and defeating them and raising funds this way. And it is believed that Mordecai said, no, let's not go and attack other people. Let's not rely on war to get an income. Let's do a taxation. So I think he was a Democrat. But anyway, he raised the taxes. I'm going to be canned. I know it. But there was prosperity in the land. And then at verse 2, we have the second part, and that is the exaltation. Now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his kindred. So the book of Esther closes with the exaltation of Mordecai. His progress is recorded alongside the accomplishment of King Ahasuerus in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia, verse 2. We do not have any of these books. So Mordecai sought the good of his people. So you can see five things that is mentioned about Mordecai. Number one, he was second to King Ahasuerus. Number two, he was great among the Jews. Number three, he was well received by the multitude of his brethren. Number four, he was seeking the good of his people. And number five, he was speaking peace to all his kindred. So here we have a description of the character of this man, Mordecai. The fact that we have no record of his death is remarkable, because the history of most men always conclude with some sort of obituary. Not so with Mordecai. We do not know what happened to him. Final note, some 1400 years later, after the events here in the book of Esther, a similar thing happened in Russia. On March 1st, 1953, 8 years after the Holocaust that took the lives of 6 million Jews, Joseph Stalin unveiled a proposal to liquidate the rest of the Jews remaining in Soviet Union, another 3 million. On that day at 12 noon, Stalin called a meeting of the Politburo in the Kremlin and read to all the Soviet leaders there his plan for the extermination of the Jews. Those 3 million gotta go. The proposal was due to go into effect on March 9, a week later. On March 2nd, the day after outlining his plan, exactly 1 week before the extermination of the other 3 million, Stalin unexpectedly dropped dead. He died of a stroke. I know who killed him. He was buried on March 9. The very same day the Jews were to be exterminated. Indeed, the Lord works in mysterious ways. The Blues Brothers said it. So the main lesson of this chapter 10 is godly, faithful men may for a time seem to be kept in obscurity, but by the hand of God, they are suddenly revealed to the world and made famous, just like this Mordecai here. So the book of Esther shows that God cares and he watches over his people. The name of God is not even mentioned once in this book. And yet, in no other book of the Bible is his providence more obvious. We see that pride goes before destruction. Sometimes, like Haman, we think that there is nobody better than we are. We think like this sometimes. We think that we are God's gift to the world. But like Haman, we might be humiliated. The Bible says that whoever exalts himself will be humble, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So Mordecai humbled himself and he was exalted. Haman exalted himself, he was humiliated. So we also see that the evil that is prepared for others might come on us. There was a gallows 75 feet prepared for someone else. And the one who prepared it ended up on it. It sure happened to a man. He had prepared the gallows to hang the man that he despised, and he ended up being hanged on it. Next week, we will continue our journey through the Bible with the sad story of Job. That's not a pleasant thing, but we're going to go through it. We don't skip over anything. It is a nice story anyway, because it's the good ending. So you can read chapters 1, 2, and 3 of Job. But it is amazing to me, you can now, we're a couple thousand years from that stories, and similar things happen. You see people trying to exalt themselves in a company, in a business, and they will step on anybody's head. They will find fault with anybody. They will accuse them to the supervisor. They try anything to take the man down, to make him get fired. They try to get his position, to get his place. And they end up being canned and being fired. The same thing as this story here. There is nothing new under the world, under the sun, in this world. So, very important that we would be humble, simple servants of the Lord. Not trying to put others down, not trying to find fault with others, not trying to exalt ourselves and putting others down. It is best for us to be humble. Let the Lord lift us up. We can try to lift ourselves up. God will take us down. So be humble. Trust Him. Walk with Him. Don't try to knock everybody out of your way and take their place. Let the Lord give you the promotion. Let Him lift you up. So may the Lord be with you. May the Lord bless each and every one of you. May He bless your work starting tomorrow. Bless your home. Bless your family. And may you walk humbly with the Lord your God all the days of your life. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.